Kevin Kleiman of Angeli Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW. Did you know that you'll eat as much food as you're given regardless of how full you are? It's called mindless eating, and we all do it. I'll tell you more about it today. Prisoners on death row get one final meal request before execution. A list of these last meals in today's show. Plus, a chance to start over in New Orleans' troubled schools, one schoolyard at a time. But first, let's see what's in season at the area farmers markets this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's the time of year when we want to think of stuff we can stick in our oven and bake and cook and braise and oven roast for the winter holidays and just for the cool weather. And we're talking with Mark Gold. Mark Gold used to be the chef at Cafe Pino, and you now have a new restaurant you're working with. And what's that one called?
It's called Leatherby's Cafe Rouge.
In Costa Mesa. All right, and Mark is here today as he is every Wednesday shopping, and you're picking up a bunch of carrots, I understand.
Beautiful-looking carrots from McGrath Farms right now. Weiser has great carrots. And at the restaurant, we're just roasting them. What we do is we put them in a hotel pan. We take a slab of bacon, smoked bacon, some thyme, a half a head of garlic, a little bit of olive oil and butter, and throw it in a 400-degree oven for about 20 minutes. Pull them out and serve them with a beautiful piece of fish or a piece of meat.
Do you use, now there's about three different kinds of carrots. There's all different colors. Do you roast them? Some, I guess, are more for eating. Some are more for roasting. Do you just use them all?
Well, right now we're using the Nanti carrot, which is it's a sweet carrot from McGrath, and they roast very, very nice.
Okay.
Extremely, they're a beautiful carrot to eat.
Right, and how about the yellow ones, and then they got the red skin, the purple-looking ones, too.
They're beautiful. Beautiful.
So you do a medley. You throw them all in there together.
We do. We do.
And you don't peel them, I suppose.
I don't peel the smaller ones. I don't peel. Sometimes the larger ones, we do peel a little bit. But for the most part, we leave them whole. We just scrub them with a brush and wash them thoroughly.
Okay.
And then we get them roasted.
Okay. And then how do you toss them in the olive oil? You put the olive and then you toss them? You take them out a couple times and stir them, right, during the roasting?
Well, no. What I do is I just open up the oven. I kind of shake the pan a little bit, and then it kind of stirs them up a little bit so they get evenly roasted.
And since they're covered, I guess they wouldn't dry out too much.
No, they come out very, very nice.
Okay, sounds wonderful. And that's just a side dish in and of itself. Nothing
exactly
else you need to do. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
That was Mark Gold. He has a great, simple recipe to use these wonderful roast carrots. And he has a brand new restaurant now, Leatherby's Cafe Rouge. And that's down in Costa Mesa. And Mark is up here at the Wednesday Market in Santa Monica shopping every week. We're visiting now with Barbara Spencer, who comes down from Paso Robles with Windrose Farm. And the Windrose Farm is famous in these parts for growing their heirloom beans, many of which are Native American beans. You got them in your bins right now, and they're like little buckets full of jewels. And tell us about them, Barbara, and then some cooking tips.
Okay, we do mostly beans that do come from the southwest region of the United States. And this year we have a whole lot of what are called tepary beans. That's T-E-P-A-R-Y. And the beauty of them is they are possibly the one true North American bean. The rest of them come from Central and Southern America originally. The whole process of being a drought-tolerant plant did something to the sugar-starch exchange, which has to do with how it's viewed as a carbohydrate, so that diabetics, this is the one kind of bean they can actually eat. And in fact, they're trying to, again, make the Indian population, the native population, eat them again because they can eat this carbohydrate. And the other thing is they're very high protein. And one of the nicest things is we have a white tepary that looks like a small Italian white bean that can make the most incredibly gorgeous vegetarian soup with a Parmesan rind instead of meat. And it comes out very rich, really good dense olive oils, good herbs, and this Parmesan rind, and you have this totally satisfying, rich meal without any meat products at all.
Parmesan rind would be
just a big hunk of old, the edge that you cut off.
The
dry end that you aren't going to use for anything else, or the kind of thing that some chef you know is going to throw out because you're not going to do anything with it.
That sounds amazing. And so what is a basic cooking way? Now, these are fresh. We got to rush to say they're fresh dried beans. So they cook pretty quick.
Yeah. The basic thing with cooking beans, it's 4 to 5 cups of water. There are three main differences. The amount of water, the cooking time is going to be longer. The tepary's might take up to 2 hours. And the other thing is that you actually want water to stay on top of the beans. It isn't like when you look at rice and say, oh, it's done because all the water's used up and absorbed. In the beans, you do want it on top, or the beans will not cook evenly. And so you really, that's the one thing you want to do is kind of have a tea kettle going with warm water to add some more water to them if you see them come to the top.
Now, your smart husband, Bill, also smokes, smokes a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But what he smokes is he smokes peppers and tomatoes.
Right.
And you have those available. And if you stick one of those in when you first start cooking the beans?
Yep, you just put it in and leave it. Use a chipotle pepper, which is a smoked jalapeno, if you like some heat to it. And if you just like smoky flavor, put in a couple of the tomatoes. And just leave them in there while they're cooking.
And then, okay, and then you're done. Then you add them to like 10,000 different recipes. How about storing them? Do you want to store them with the water still on top?
No, you want to drain them for storage. And one of the best things to do is, let's say you've made a big pot of beans and you're only using 2 cups out of it. Take the rest, drain them, put them in Ziplocs in the freezer.
So the beans that you have here, when did you harvest? They're just harvested.
They were harvested. The plants, we do most of it by hand. The plants were pulled by hand, stacked, and then we drive over them with an explorer, Ford Explorer, which is the perfect weight for separating the beans from the pods and the bushes. And the thing is, they're only, you know, out of the field a month, 6 weeks at the most. Because the other thing is, when you go to the store, one of the biggest differences when you get beans from stores, they are old, often 2 years or more old, because we compare it to our old beans, and they must be old geriatric, beans. God knows. And the other thing is that the other beans have all been treated with methyl bromide.
All right, Barbara, and what markets? You're at the Wednesday Santa Monica. Where else do you come
Santa Barbara Saturday. That's
Santa
it.
Barbara
Saturday,
and then you're
that's
on the farm driving your Ford around squashing beans.
Yep.
That was Barbara Spencer. Wow, more than I ever knew about beans. And she's got a stand here at the Wednesday Market. And these beans, honestly, they're just beautiful to look at. Get your beans, because they're only going to be around for a couple of months.
You're at the movies. There's a large bucket of popcorn in front of you. Studies show that you'll eat nearly all of it, and it's not because you're hungry. The reason is simply because it's there. It's called mindless eating, and fat or thin, we all do it. I'll tell you more about this phenomenon of human behavior when Good Food returns. Fat or thin, you're likely to eat a number of things today, not because they taste good or because you're hungry. You'll eat them because they are there. Today, you're also destined to eat everything on your plate or in your bowl long after you've lost the feeling of hunger. Brian Wansink of Cornell University calls it mindless eating, and it accounts for thousands of calories each week that our body doesn't need. Professor Wansink is a consumer psychologist. He's the director of Cornell's Food and Brand Lab, and his research exposes some frightening aspects to our behavior around food. What is mindless eating?
Well, it's eating more than we want or eating more frequently than we want. One thing that we find out is that the typical person believes they make about 15 decisions about food a day. In reality, we make well over 200 decisions about food. I mean, even for breakfast, you decide what cereal to have, but then whether to have half a bowl, a full bowl, 2 bowls, whether to put skim or whole milk, whether to put sugar, whether to put a banana. All these little bitty decisions end up being made, you know, bam, like even before you start eating. And that's where mindless eating starts creeping into our life and often leading us to eat more than we want.
What are some of the factors that play a role in having us make all these decisions?
Well, some of the things that influence us is we largely believe that when we overeat because we're really, really hungry or because the food is really, really good. In reality, what has a bigger influence on us in a lot of cases just ends up being sort of the cues that are around us, what the signals in our environment are telling us to do. So, for instance, we brought some people in to a movie theater who had just finished eating dinner and they were coming in the theater to see a movie. And we gave them either a huge bucket of popcorn or a medium bucket of popcorn. Now, these are people who had just eaten, so they weren't even hungry. But this popcorn was terrible. It was 5 days old. It was like eating little styrofoam pellets. But even though these people were full, even though the popcorn was terrible, over the course of the movie, they ate 35% more popcorn than was in one of these huge buckets because everything around them told them to eat. The people next to them were eating, so they dutifully ate. You're watching the movie, and, you know, when you're at a movie, what do? You eat popcorn, so they dutifully ate. The bucket was bigger, suggesting a larger consumption norm, so they dutifully moved ahead.
Now, what does that mean, larger consumption norm?
Well, when we're trying to figure out how much we want to eat, there's no FDA guideline we use to kind of say how much mashed potatoes we should dish out. There's no FDA guideline that we know or can remember that tells us how many French fries to eat. So what we do is we look around for what would be a normal amount or an appropriate amount to eat. And if in some cases it ends up being how many come in a pack. If we end up having a medium-sized pack of French fries, we go, well, that must be normal, appropriate, typical, reasonable to eat the full pack because that's what it comes in. Similarly, these norms can be self-influenced. And here's where things are really dangerous. They can be self-influenced by the size of bowls we serve from and the size of plates we serve onto or even the size of scoops we use, that all of these subtly suggest to us what the appropriate amount to eat is. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you're going to dish out 6 ounces of pasta onto an 8-inch plate. I mean, that would look like a nice, normal, appropriate amount. But that same 6 ounces on a 12-inch plate, I mean, it wouldn't even look like an appetizer. So what we'd do, we'd put a little bit more on.
Now, I understand that you did some research involving a bottomless bowl of soup. Could you tell us about that?
That's right. You know, if you ask people how they know they've had enough to eat, people will frequently say, I know that I've had enough to eat when my plate's empty or, you know, my bowl's empty. We thought, what would happen if a bowl never emptied? So what we did is we took a bunch of soup bowls, drilled holes in the bottom of these soup bowls so that we could kind of string this food-grade tubing up through the hole in tables and then lead the other end over these big 6-quart cauldrons of soup that were in actually another room. Well, we did this, and then we invited people in for lunch. And what had happened, people would sit down either eating from normal bowls or eating from these refillable soup bowls, which would, you know, you could eat, but you'd never, ever, ever get below halfway full because after it got to about the halfway point in the bowl, it would slowly refill and stay at that level. So people ate for 20 minutes. After 20 minutes, we stopped lunch, and we asked people, if they're full. And the people who had the refillable soup bowls ate 73% more soup. But if you asked them if they're any more full, they said, no, I'm not full. Geez, there's still half a bowl of soup left. How could I be full? And this is the problem. We eat with our eyes, not with our stomach. So anything that biases our eyes ends up being something that biases how much we eat.
In the course of doing all these different studies you do, have there been some that have been just incredibly interesting to you personally or gave you a complete surprise?
People refuse to believe that they are not master and commander of their own food lives. And so when you show them that, hey, something as strange as the shape of a glass can cause you to pour more, people refuse to believe it. We did this study where we show that if people pour in a short, wide glasses, like tumblers, they end up pouring more than in tall, skinny glasses. Almost everybody pours 28% more in a short, wide glass than a tall, skinny glass. And it's so sort of metaphorical for what all of us do is we refuse to believe that we, a smart, intelligent, independent-minded person, could be fooled by something as ridiculous as the shape of a glass. We did a lot of studies on candy bowls and how if you remove a candy bowl just 6 feet away from an office worker's desk, they end up eating half as much over the course of a day. And if you put it in an opaque bowl rather than a clear bowl, they end up eating even a couple candies less each day.
Now, when you did this candy research and you moved it away, what was the perception of the people who were eating it? Did they perceive that they were eating less?
Oh, that's a great question, because what we did is, and we did this for a month, every night we'd come in and refill it with candy. But what's interesting is at the end of this month, when we would talk with these people, we say, wait a minute, do you realize that you ate 9 Hershey Kisses every single day that was on your desk? But when it was moved just 6 feet away, that went down to 4 Hershey Kisses. Well, first of all, 5 Hershey Kisses is a difference of 125 calories a day. And if you were to do this for 365 days, you'd weigh 12.5 pounds more by having it on your desk. But when we ask people, So what's the difference with 6 feet? Is it too much of a hassle just to walk 2 steps to get candy? What's interesting is they said, it's not that it's so much more effort, but it's that 6 feet gives me pause to ask myself, am I really that hungry? And half the time they'd answer, no, I guess I'm not.
So it becomes less mindless.
Absolutely. That just having a little break in there makes it less mindless. We found the same thing for dinners, that if you ended up moving the serving bowls back onto the kitchen, what happened is the typical person ate 30% less food over the course of their dinner, simply because they had to get up and take 2 steps to get seconds or thirds.
So interesting. Thanks a lot for coming by. It was really wonderful talking with you.
Oh, it's great to be with you. I appreciate it.
You can participate in your own mindless eating study on Professor Wansink's mindless eating website. Go to kcrw.com and search Good Food for the link to the site. For more on this interesting subject, you can also check out Brian Wansink's book, Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. It's a perfect book to read during the holiday indulgence. There's one thing I could eat mindlessly almost every day. It's pie. Apparently, I'm not alone. There's a group of friends we found who celebrate Pie-mas. That's kind of like Christmas, but for pies. The meal is all pies, from start to finish. More on that next, when Good Food continues. I love pies. Now, I have to say it's really beyond that I love pies. They're definitely in my top 3 favorite foods. I love everything about them, if they're well made, that is, of course. The crust, And the filling, fruit preferably, but I seem to be flirting with savory pies. So when I heard about Pie-mas, I was intrigued. Let's find out together how Pie-mas began. Meet Al Ilya. Hi, Al.
Hello, Evan.
Pie-mas. Is it meant to sound sort of like Christmas?
That's exactly what it was meant to sound like and sort of how it started. About 5 or 6 years ago, we had had a Thanksgiving dinner where a friend of mine who was in charge of making dessert made 9 pies for 8 people. And
my kind of person.
Well, she doesn't like having to decide between things, and so she made them all. And someone said, geez, we could actually have a whole meal with just the pies. And then someone else said, hey, that's a really good idea. And thus Pie-mas was born.
Does Pie-mas have a particular date?
Not a particular date. It is usually some weekend between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
What is the balance between sweet and savory pies?
Usually they're separated into the appetizer pies, main course pies, which are the mostly savory pies, and then dessert pies.
What would appetizer pies be?
Little turnovers like spanakopita, these wonderful Arabian lamb pies that we found a recipe for long ago on the internet, which are sort of little individual meat pies, sometimes little quichelets. occasionally we'll do if it's a light pizza type or a focaccia type thing, we'll do that as an appetizer pie as well.
Now, tell me one or two of the big hits, the best savory pie that everybody just went wild with acclaim for, and the best dessert pie.
I would say that some version of a quiche Lorraine, I think, has been served at every Pie-mas going back many years. Traditionally, we've had something that one of my friends brought, which he called the kosher for Passover, but not kosher quiche Lorraine, as it had a matzah meal crust.
Did it have a matzah meal crust with bacon in the filling?
Yes, it did, which is why it was kosher for Passover, but not kosher. And I'd have to say that for dessert pie, the one that comes back every single year, and I will admit part of it is it's easy, but part of it is also that it's just so good, is the grasshopper pie.
Now, what is a grasshopper pie?
It has an Oreo crust, a crushed Oreo crust, and a filling with creme de menthe in it, where you basically make the filling, pour it into the crust, and then put it into the freezer to set. So it's almost like an ice cream pie, but not as heavy as an ice cream.
Wow. I don't think I've ever had a grasshopper pie. Now, what are you known for? What is your contribution?
I am actually known for hosting and providing the wine for the event.
You get off cheap.
Exactly. I make Pimas happen, and I get other people to do the, you know, pie production work. I've helped somewhat in some of the pies, but I often end up being the person who is in charge of crushing the Oreos for the grasshopper pie crust.
Now, have there been any great failures, pies, where people just said, boy, that just shouldn't be in a pie?
The one catastrophic failure actually occurred last year. We had made a chicken pie where the filling bubbled over the side, and when we opened the oven to check on the pie, a giant plume of smoke came out and set off the fire alarms for the entire building.
Well, that was memorable. That would be a memorable pie.
Indeed. It was, and it was, in fact, a remarkably tasty pie, which we all agreed was, you know, a good thing, given the, you know, stress that it caused to everyone living in the building and the Pimas goers that year. When the fire department showed up, we offered them some pie, but they declined.
Oh, that's not very nice of them. Thank you so much, Al.
Thank you.
You can create your own holiday or check out our website for links to pictures of Pimas past. Go to kcrw.com and search Good Food. In this season of Focus on the Bible, I always wonder about the food of this time. What was eaten during that noted period in history? Well, nothing makes me happier than to talk to a scholar about such subjects. More on bread, fishes, and wine. That's next on Good Food. The holidays, of course, brings with it culinary traditions. But how far back can we go? Is the Bible also a culinary guide? Reverend Dr. Rainer Hesse Jr. and Anthony Cifolo have written Cooking with the Bible, Biblical Food, Feasts, and Lore. So we've asked Dr. Hesse to come by and share what he learned with us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
What period of time are we talking about when we talk about biblical times?
Let's say from about 2000 BCE to about 110 is the biblical period.
So during the course of your research, did you get a sense of what people ate in general in biblical times?
Sure. One of the things that we knew that they were very much vegetarians in many ways, there was not a lot of meat eaten unless it was a special occasion. Let's say somebody was getting married or the prodigal son had come home, or angels were visiting with you, then you might go and kill the fatted calf, or you might have a special lamb dinner. Otherwise, almost everything was of vegetarian nature.
What are some of the earliest mentions of food or cooking in the Old Testament?
Well, one way to answer that maybe is to say what one of the earliest isn't. A lot of people will tell you right away about the story of Adam and Eve and the apple. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew scripture, it doesn't say anything about what type of fruit it was. It just says a fruit. And so it wasn't an apple. If it were any type of fruit that might have looked like an apple, it was probably an apricot, which are in great abundance in the Middle East. After that, one of the first meals that's really mentioned is when we get to the story of Abraham and Isaac, Jacob, the patriarchal figures in the book of Genesis. And there we see that they had cattle, that they had some means of making cheese, some means of gathering honey, and some means of making bread.
Given that during that period of time, so many people were still nomadic, how did it affect their eating? Is there a mention of gathering of herbs, for example?
A lot of times there's not a mention of gathering anything. They just happen to have it. In some cases, let's say with Esau, we know that he went out and hunted game. We're told that in the story of Jacob. Also, we're told that he was a farmer, and so he must have done some gathering. But there's not any real stories that I recall of people gathering anything, except for maybe when you get to the book of Ruth, where she's actually out in the fields gathering sheaves of grain.
Could you give an example of a dish that's pretty unusual by our modern eating practices that you came across?
Locust soup.
Boy, that was just on the tip of your tongue.
I'm going to send you some just so you can experience that to go along with your laugh.
did you actually make it?
Yes. That's probably one of the most unusual ones we did. Although we have some other ones that are really way out there also. I think that was the most fun one. And when people see that, they go, wow, if this is what your whole book is like, I don't know that I want to buy it. We say, no, that was an anomaly, really. But we were trying to be very authentic. Although in that particular story about locusts, which has to do with John the Baptist, we go to great lengths to show that it was a mistranslation. He wasn't actually eating locust. He was eating the fruit of the locust tree. It was a one-letter translation error.
And are they called locust trees because it's a tree that locusts really like to devour when they're flying through?
No, I imagine that they're called that because the seed pods look like little locusts. They're about the same shape and size. That's my guess.
Now, one of the most fascinating parts of the book talks about a meal that Jesus cooked for the disciples. Could you talk a little bit about what he prepared and what meal it was?
After the resurrection, the disciples are out fishing and they see somebody on the shore. They're not sure who it is. And he's cooking them breakfast. And they come in and they realize that it is Jesus. He cooks them a meal of fish. And the way he does it, as far as we know, the traditional way of doing it in those days, was to take the fish and build a campfire, put the fish on sticks around the campfire so that the fish would cook pretty quickly, and you just turn the sticks around a little bit so that all sides of the fish are ready to go. We did some studies to see what type of fish were available. At that time in the Sea of Galilee, a very common fish would be tilapia, sunfish. And that's probably what they were eating, some version of what is called in California, I think now, tilapia. It's a very white fish, and it's pretty easy to cook, cooks fast, has almost no discernible taste, and so you have to add some other spices and things to it, which is what we do in our chapter.
And where does wine enter the picture?
At the very beginning, when the meals are first mentioned, there's wine present. But the type of wine, I think there's seven different words for wine in the Hebrew scripture, for instance, and the story of Jacob and Isaac, where Jacob fools his father Isaac into thinking that it's his brother Esau and steals Esau's blessing. The type of wine there that's mentioned is a very thick wine that's made of honey. It has really no grape in it at all. It's sort of like what was called mead in the Middle Ages. And it gets you drunk instantly because it's so heavy and thick. And when you realize that, we try to talk about these word studies in our book, the story comes alive in a way that, for instance, I've been a preacher for 25 years. I never knew some of this, and it's been very, very great in trying to explain the stories to my congregation about the ways that people ate and what difference that made to the outcome of the story.
Really fascinating. Thank you so much for doing all the research and for spending some time with us.
Thanks. It's really been great to be with you.
Cooking with the Bible, Biblical Food, Feasts, and Lore is Reverend Dr. Rainer Hess's work. It's a fascinating look at the food of biblical times. Speaking of the Last Supper, there are Last Suppers that take place inside America's death row on a frequent basis. And the Internet is, of course, the great collector of morbid obsessions. So next, a rundown of final meal requests from a man who collects these menus. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW. And KCRW.com. Have you ever sat around the dinner table with friends and posed the question, what would you eat for your last meal? Mike Randleman is a blogger who gives this question a lot of thought. He maintains a website about the people on death row and their last meal choices. What made you start doing this?
Well, I'm an actor here in Los Angeles, and I had my own personal website called Randleman Land, where I would put humorous essays and other things that interest me up on it. And sadly, the last meals were more interesting than my humorous essays, so I spun it off into its own website.
Do you have any idea where the tradition of offering a last meal came from?
You know, there's a lot of debate about that, and no one really knows. Some people think it goes back to the Last Supper. Some people think it goes back 100 years just to keep everyone calm, because executions used to be big public spectacles and thousands of people would come and they just wanted to keep the prisoner calm. But there's no definitive this is where the first last meal started.
Do all states have the same policies regarding menus?
No, it's very different from state to state. And some states have dollar limits. In Oklahoma, it's $15. You can't go over that. In Florida, it's $20. And the federal government is $20. The state of Texas, if they don't have it in the kitchen, then you don't get it. There was a recent prisoner who wanted Cool Whip and cherries for his last meal, and they didn't have it. But fortunately, a sympathetic guard went out and bought the Cool Whip and cherries for him.
It seems like so little money. Now, when you go on your blog, you actually have entries with the prisoner's name, the date of execution, and then quite a lot of details about the last meal. When you started compiling, when your blog got bigger and longer, did you find that you were getting a different type of response, not just about the food?
Well, actually, the nature of the blogs changed from when I started it. I was kind of flip, you know, as I was starting it and would make a little jokes here and there. But as you keep doing it over the years, this is our fifth year, there are some pretty heinous things you're writing about that it's not as flip as it used to be. To me, it's not a pro-death penalty side, and it's not an anti-death penalty side. It's just a matter-of-fact presentation of this is what the crime was, this is what the person ate, this is the if there's something unusual about the execution, something doesn't jibe, we put that as well.
I understand that in some states, in fact, you only get one last meal. So if your sentence is commuted.
Yeah, that of all the last meal things, that bothers me the most. Like in the state of Florida, let's say you have your last meal and you get a call from the governor and you get the reprieve. If you come back, you know, your execution day comes up again, you're out of luck. You eat.
You already ate it.
Burritos and beans and whatever they're eating in the, steamed cabbage. I don't know. You don't get a special last meal.
So give us a range of what some people request.
Most of the executions take place in the South, and predominantly it is Southern comfort food. You get a lot of fried chicken. Everybody has French fries. There's steak. But then there are different meals. I like it when, you know, somebody makes a statement with their last meal, like they want world peace, one guy asked for. I don't think it's come true yet. And candy is my favorite. When people just order like a whole bag of Jolly Ranchers or Whoppers, I like the candy orders.
Now, I understand that one gentleman wanted an olive.
Yeah, that's we have on our website our top 10 last meals that we've ranked with the famous people like John Wayne Gacy and Bundy. But this one gentleman wanted just one unpitted olive, and they didn't know why. So finally, they researched it, and it turns out there was an executed guy in the 60s who had the one unpitted olive, and his dream was, as his body disintegrated, that would take root and grow into an olive tree, which is a symbol of peace.
That's sort of a very interesting and sort of poignant request. How do you get your information?
Well, you know, it's out there. Most of it comes from newspaper accounts of the execution. The state of Texas sends me a fax, which, since they're the busiest state, kind of helps.
So let's go through one of the top 10, and just read the whole entry for me, because it isn't just that you have a menu listed.
Well, one of the most famous ones is this Thomas Grazzo in Oklahoma from 1995. And he had a dozen steamed mussels, a Burger King double cheeseburger with mustard and mayonnaise, a can of Franco-American spaghetti with meatballs. And that's where the trouble came in, because as he was on the gurney, his last words were, "I want the media to know I did not get my SpaghettiOs. I got spaghettis. I just want you to know that." So that's what he took his final words to say.
Is there a single most requested food?
It's always usually fried chicken. It's the people who like fried chicken for their last meal.
I'm sort of amazed that they're able to eat.
Well, that's – no one really knows that. Sometimes in the press accounts they'll say, and so-and-so ate every bite. But I would think that a lot of them don't eat. There's a good number of people who have no final meal request, and a couple of people don't want their final meal request made public.
Are most of the last meals cooked in-house, or is a lot of it sort of reflective of how more and more people are growing up on fast food, so fast food becomes the comfort food?
There's been a trend lately of a lot of fast food restaurants. They'll note that it was from KFC or Domino's. For some states, like Texas keeps it in-house, but the other ones, they'll go out and get Chinese food for you or whatever, if it stays within the limit. But we always know it if it's from a place, because John Wayne Gacy was always an interesting one. He was a manager at KFC before, you know, he killed the 33 little boys. And then for his last meal, he had KFC. So that was,
it had some actual meaning to him.
Those Colonel Spices stuck with him for a long time. Oh.
Well, Mike, I really want to thank you for sort of taking on a really edgy project for your part of your life's work.
Well, like I said, as I've started it, it's really evolved into something more than it was meant to be. Right now we're working on a couple of books, like a crime cookbook, which would combine the two. And then we have our the year-end review book, and we break it down, Coke versus Pepsi, Dr. Pepper versus Big Red. If you want to know what they had, it'll be in our year-end Death Row Dining Guide, we call it.
Wow. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dead Man Eating is the name of Michael Randleman's blog. You can find the link on our website at kcrw.com. Search for good food. And now for some good news. Before Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans, that city was noted for the poor state of its public education. With devastation often comes rebirth, and now there are many new ideas that are being put into action in the schools. One is an import from Alice Waters Edible Schoolyard in Berkeley, California. More on this ray of hope when Good Food continues. Across the country, many of us may periodically think about the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, but for those in New Orleans, it's still a daily struggle just to put lives back together. Through a program called Edible Schoolyard, Donna Cavado is helping to rebuild a school and to restore some beauty and joy to the lives of the students and the community as well. Welcome to the show, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the Edible Schoolyard for those who don't know about its homeland in Berkeley, should I say.
The Edible Schoolyard in Berkeley is a 10-year-old program where students of a public school there are participating in hands-on organic gardening and kitchen lessons. And it is so much more than kids learning how to grow food or how to prepare food. It's actually integrated into their curriculum.
Tell us a little bit about Samuel J. Green Charter School. Who are the kids? What kind of community is it in? And is it a special school? Is it a magnet?
It's not a magnet. It is a public school. And what that means is a child from anywhere in the city can come to our school. Our population is 98% African American. Most of the kids, probably about 96%, live below the poverty line. So it's a very high-need population, and we really feel like the Edible Schoolyard is really trying to rebuild community in so many ways. The school community, as well as the surrounding community. Green Charter is located in an uptown neighborhood, I would say a working-class neighborhood, and the site for our organic garden is surrounded by people's front porches. So while we're in the garden, we can see many neighbors. There is a lot of interest by senior citizens that live around the garden and the parents. Really excited that this school has gone through an incredible, really, transformation since Katrina.
Can you talk a little bit about the effect that it's had on the children, particularly in light of the sort of devastation that they've experienced because of Katrina?
The children are really learning a respect for life, which is so important in New Orleans. We unfortunately live in a very violent society. We have a very high crime rate. And it's really incredible how students can make a connection to a little tiny seed or a transplant, and they can nurture that, and it can grow into a lettuce plant or a tomato bush. And that connection really transfers over to their relationships with other students, with other teachers, and that respect for life is very deep. What we have seen in our very short time being at Green, which has only been about 2 months, we are seeing students come on their own to check their plants, and it's there where these conversations are really happening. Students will feel comfortable to share what has been going on in their lives since Katrina. One third grader, when we were planting, was asking questions if we gave the plant too much water and what might happen. It was through that opportunity that he shared that he lost a family member in Katrina, and he said it so matter-of-factly. And it really reminded us that it is those opportunities in small groups in a small setting that it is there that we can generally best connect with the students and see what's happening in their lives.
And what about the actual physical, tactile, and sensual aspect of the children coming into contact with the color and the flavor of the food?
It's really a complete opening up of the senses. It's amazing to have a child taste something that we take so for granted. At our watermelon tasting, kids had said they had just never tasted anything so good. To look at a flower and seeing such beautiful colors and shapes and patterns, and to hear them articulate how that makes them feel, and that the aesthetic world, it can be beautiful, and that beauty really plays a major role in nature. And so they're learning science through that. They're also learning how we think and feel and communicate with each other, and how we all deserve and we all can work to make New Orleans into the beautiful place that it was, and even a more beautiful place.
Donna, thank you so much. It's really a wonderful, heartwarming story, the kind we need to hear.
Well, thank you. We appreciate being able to talk to you about it.
Donna Cavado is from the Edible Schoolyard, New Orleans. To find a link, go to kcrw.com and search Good Food. The holidays are a time to share stories of goodness. There's so much excess food in America, it's hard to fathom that some go hungry here. The solution seems so simple, though. Get the extra food from one place and take it over to the people who need it the most. Coming up on Good Food, I'll tell you about a program in L.A. that does just this. That's next on KCRW and KCRW.com. We've all been at parties where the buffet stretches out forever, and it seems that no number of people could finish the food. Well, what happens to all that leftover food? It seems criminal just to throw it away when so many people are hungry. Well, that's what Helen Pallett thought. This simple idea of bringing excess food to people in need was the beginning of Angel Harvest. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you.
Tell me a typical Southern California pickup and delivery.
Okay. You're going to have an event, a wedding, a bar mitzvah, corporate event. You tell us where the event is, who do we meet, and our driver will be there with our refrigerated truck. If there is no leftover foods, that's okay. If there is food, our driver packs it up, gives you a receipt immediately, which is fully tax deductible, and within an hour, he has delivered it to a soup kitchen or a shelter for their next meal.
How much food is moving here in Southern California from donors who have too much to people who have too little?
With Angel Harvest on a given day, We're picking up and delivering enough food for over 4,000 meals. This is incredible produce. This is catered food from Wolfgang Puck, Along Came Mary, Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, whoever's on the schedule for that day.
Does that cause sometimes odd juxtapositions of people and food? Do you sometimes find that you have food that is so sort of effete on one level that the recipients can't really relate to it and don't perceive it as a good?
We've picked up caviar in all different colors, and so we just explained that it was a really nice seasoning. Okay. As long as it's been good food, everyone can use it. We're also delivering the food based on religious and medical needs. We're not going to take pork to some groups. We're not going to take beef to other groups out of respect for their religion. Poppy seeds will make a reformed drug addict test positive. We'll just take them to another program. Alcohol, even though the alcohol has been used as a sauce, the alcohol itself burns out, but the smell for a reformed alcoholic is enough to set them off again. And the rum balls go to the seniors.
Love that. The rum balls go to the seniors. Now, we often think about hunger as being a problem in developing countries. Give us an idea of what hunger is like right here in Southern California.
One out of four children in Los Angeles is hungry.
Oh, that's just horrific.
25 million people in America are hungry.
Is this a lot of the working poor?
It is a working poor, but it's also 20 years ago, the people who were hungry were basically men. It was like 98% were men. 30% of them used to be veterans. And it was usually men of minority, men of color. Women, we all wanted equal rights. Well, we also got our equal rights in the hunger line. And now women are showing up almost 50%. Usually coming in with families, working poor. Sometimes they're working one, two, and three jobs to make ends meet in this current economy. The other group that is growing dramatically is seniors. These are people who've worked hard, you know, paid their taxes, done all that, but maybe their pension fund ran out. And seniors are now making a choice. They either fill their medical prescription or they go to the grocery store. In a land of plenty.
Before we came on the air, you showed me a map that you had prepared of dots, and the dots were red and green, representing red for hunger, green for donors. And as one would imagine, anybody who lives in Southern California, the green was concentrated in the west area of the map, and the red was concentrated in the east area of the map. But one part of the map, which was quite interesting, was this one almost triangle downtown. Can you tell me about that concentrated area of feeding?
Downtown, you have 101 on the one side, you have the 110 on the other, and you have the 10 on the south. In this area, this triangle, which is basically 30 blocks by 30 blocks, there are 106 soup kitchens, shelters, and food pantries in this one block.
And how many people would you estimate that they're taking care of on a daily basis?
There are four programs in this block that are serving 1,000 people a day.
Wow.
But the generosity of people in Los Angeles help all of these programs to feed the people.
In addition to the food that you take, your core mission of bringing food to those in need, you obviously need operating funds as well. How are you funded?
Angel Harvest is funded by the generosity of corporations, foundations, and people. And 92 cents of the dollar you send us fuels our system.
Thank you so much, Helen.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Helen Pallett, founder of Angel Harvest. You can go onto their website at angelharvest.org and learn how you can get involved.
Thank you.
of us are fascinated by the minds of food writers and chefs, and it seems one of the places uniquely difficult to inhabit. So much of what's created there seems to flow with so little effort, yet the connections made to create a particular dish are often so varied and can connect with moments as disparate as a 19th century novel and a recent meal in a super hip restaurant. So imagine reading a diary of one of the most gifted and interesting food writers working today. London-based food writer Nigel Slater has authored a number of cookbooks I treasure. His autobiographical book, Toast, A Story of Childhood Remembered Through Food, won 6 major awards, including the British Biography of the Year. But his latest, Kitchen Diaries, is absolutely fascinating, a year in the life of a man who cooks and thinks. He shares personal stories along with his engaging knowledge of the seasonality of food. Welcome, Nigel.
Thank you.
So could you describe for us what you mean by right food, right place, right time?
It's a funny thing, you know. It's just the feeling that I get when I eat something out of season, something that's maybe been imported, it's been flown in, you know, it can be perfectly delicious. But eating a fruit or a vegetable that I know is absolutely at its best, it hasn't had to travel very far, it's been picked at the perfect moment, it just feels right.
Now, one of the things that fascinates me, too, is some of the suppers that you make are incredibly simple. You do a lot of piling things on toast, sort of what we would call a bruschetta, but they're very improvisational and really of the season. Could you share a couple of your toast piles for us?
Well, we've got some wonderful cabbages, and particularly the black cabbages are starting to come into season now, and they've got quite a strident flavor. And what I love doing is to cook them in a little bit of butter. I always think butter works in many ways better with cabbage than olive oil, but a little bit of butter, and just soften them with some garlic and just let it stew down just a wee bit so that it's soft and starting to melt. And then I will just pile that on top of some very crisp hot toast, quite thick, and then a squeeze of lemon and maybe a grating of Parmesan cheese or a cheese that's very similar to Parmesan, and that on toast is just one of the best things.
Now, another thing I noticed about quite a few of your fall menus is your abundant use of walnut oil. Does walnut oil particularly appeal to you in the fall?
Yes. I think when the nuts are starting to come into the shops, the new season's nuts, and of course they're starting to press the nuts into the oils, there's something about the warmth of their flavor. I mean, olive oil, obviously it's a great all-year oil, but there's something very summery about it. And the nutty oils, as I say, they have a warmth and a depth to them. But I do find that sometimes they can be a little bit overpowering on their own in a salad. So I make sure that either I use a little bit of flavorless oil with them, something like groundnuts or something, or vegetable, or indeed olive oil works with them, so that it's not too strong. There's just a kind of a hint of nuts. And, I mean, right now they're starting to cook the chestnuts in the street. So you've got this lovely nutty smell as you're walking through the city.
Do you ever use the walnut oil in dishes that aren't salad?
I don't find it terribly good when you warm it. It's much better either just cold straight from the bottle, or perhaps if you poured it over squash or something that had been cooked, had been roasted maybe, and you just drizzled a little bit over towards the end of cooking, I do that, but I try not to actually heat it up because I think, apart from that, it burns very quickly, just as nuts do. I think it also loses something of its magic.
I know that all of us seem to have a dish that we fall back on over and over because everybody just loves to eat it, and it seems to be really easy to do. You have something called the knee-jerk lentil supper.
Yes, I mean, lentils to me, I just find that the small lentils, the little dark green ones or the brown ones, they actually cook really quite quickly. For me, anything with lentils in. I mean, there is a very quick lentil soup I do where I just soften a few onions and put the lentils in. any stock that might be about, although, to be honest, it's quite often water. And then whatever else is around, I mean, maybe a little bit of cabbage, maybe some fresh beans. It ends up being, I suppose, about half an hour from start to finish. But I also do love lentils just cooked as they are, drained, and then just pour over some olive oil and maybe some chopped herbs. And quite often a little bit of cheese. I'll put maybe some Greek feta cheese or some sheep's cheese, something very sharp to go with the earthiness of the lentils.
And I guess it sort of would be impossible for me to talk to you without bringing up like a trifle-y custardy thing, because you seem to have such a great love for them.
I do. You know, I when I wrote my autobiography, I was unaware until I actually started writing about the food I'd eaten as a child, just how fond I was of puddings. Not just hot ones, but the very cold custardy ones that you mentioned. And of course, it's my comfort food. And I've never really let go of that. And although I don't really need food as comfort in the way I used to when I was younger and maybe not so settled, I still like that comfort eating. And the fact that something is sweet and a little bit creamy and very often fruity, I mean, that's why I love trifle. It takes me back, I suppose, to, you know, those safe moments when you had a pudding at a party as a child, you know, at a birthday party or something.
Nigel, thank you so much.
No, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
That was London-based food writer Nigel Slater. His latest book, which is a gem, is The Kitchen Diaries, A Year in the Kitchen with Nigel Slater. You can find all the info from today's show at kcrw.com, search Good Food, or click on the Talk menu. The show can be podcast too. Go to iTunes or KCRW for details, and don't forget to check out the new video podcast. The executive producer of Good Food is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced by Bea Chaloner with Bob Carlson, Marina McLeod, Candace Moyer, Priya Fenimore, Holly Tarson, and Whitney Alderson. I'm Evan Kleiman. I hope you tune in again next week for another edition of Good Food.